This is the Takeaway Weekender. I'm John Hockenberry. Look around you. Are you at home? If you look out your window, do you see a place that's completely familiar? Well, what if that place that seems so familiar to you surprises and shocks? Nepal certainly did that to the people who live in the holy mountains that shook in last weekend's deadly earthquake. This weekend, we will marvel at how a place that is among the most scrutinized in the world, Israel and the occupied territories, have the capacity to surprise.
This idea that you can't show empathy for both Israelis and Palestinians, I think it's really troubling. I mean, I have empathy for all kinds of people, and I don't think that it's a zero-sum game.
They are home to the New York Times' Jody Rodoran for the past 3 years as Times bureau chief. She shares with us how she keeps fresh eyes on a place full of surprises. But the home we will begin with in this edition of The Weekender is a place where the view out the window suddenly became one of outrage and unrest, a place called Baltimore.
Just tired, man, of the police brutality. It shouldn't affect on a community like this.
I pray it'll stop, but I see it getting worse.
You come into a community that looks exactly like the public housing that you saw in The Wire, then you're more than likely, I think, to bring the biases with you.
You know, in front of that police station, you think everybody would be embarrassed in the city just to see the conditions that people live under right around here.
We just want justice.
Although he had a pocket knife, they shouldn't have killed him. That wasn't right.
Hard times in a city, in a hard time by the sea.
We have to hold it up until we die.
Ain't nowhere to run to, ain't nothing here for free.
We have to fight, although we have to die.
Looking at how society here has forgotten about this community.
And when you look around, you see really the vastness and diversity of this city. And we all here together.
I won't say that it's warranted. Amen. I would say that there is an underlying issue. And anger causes people to react in many different ways.
We can start right here in Baltimore City and demand justice for all of our people. And we don't care whether you're black, whether you're white, or whether you're gay, or whether you're Jew, or whether you're Catholic, whether you're male or female, we are one city, one community, and we stand right here, right now, on the corner of this street, in front of this police department, and we tell them right now that we're demanding justice for Freddie Gray.
The whole damn system!
The six officers involved in the death of Freddie Gray that erupted in protests and turmoil have all been charged with offenses that led to his death. It is just the latest event in a more than week-long story that has delivered heartbreaking images of protest, frightening images of flaming buildings and vandalism, and dozens of injured police officers, citizens, and many arrests. There was also that eerie, unprecedented image of a baseball game played in an empty stadium.
Warming once again for the White Sox, number 67, Scott Carroll.
The Baltimore Orioles makeup game in a vacant Camden Yards might have been a detail that former reporter David Simon, who created the TV series set in Baltimore, The Wire, could have come up with, but I doubt it. I suspect he doubts it too. We wanted to know what some of the characters from The Wire thought of the upheavals in Baltimore, so we found someone who played one tough cop from the streets in that series. Let's spend a moment with Detective Bunk Moreland trying to set a young punk straight from The Wire.
I was a few years ahead of you at Edmondson, but I know you remember the neighborhood, how it was. We had some bad boys for real. It wasn't about guns so much as knowing what to do with your hands. Those boys could really rack. As rough as that neighborhood could be, we had us a community. Nobody, no victim who didn't matter. And now all we got is bodies.
That's Wendell Pierce playing Bunk Moreland, a murder detective on the wire with a seething anger about the changes he sees on his tough streets. Pierce shared his sadness and anger over how this week Baltimore, a place he lived in for years, had the capacity to surprise even him.
It's been a pretty remarkable week. I've been on an emotional roller coaster, actually, just hearing that scene and combining that with the images and what's been happening in Baltimore. It really affects me and touches me. For a decade, over a decade ago, we examined the humanity of the people of that city and the dysfunction of policy and how it can be very destructive to people's lives. We were holding, as it were, a mirror up to nature, as Shakespeare says, and really demonstrating the power of what culture and
Jody
art
Redoran,
can be.
Jody Redoran, for 3 years, the New York Times
forum where
Bureau
we collectively think about where we are.
Back home in that place.
See our triumphs, see our failures, and then
thanks for listening to The Weekender. We love
what
having you
about
join us, and you can
and
find us
them.
And The Weekender and
What's
be a part of the takeaway
is, even with
all
that
week
reflection
long by
about
just going to thetakeaway.org.
Where we are as a society and the dysfunction and the impact that it can have on poor people's lives, the one step that hasn't taken, the one step we haven't taken is acting on it. That is the final step of what the whole cultural, process is about. And we watched it kind of explode in Baltimore this week.
So much of the scenes and the dialogue and the character interactions in The Wire is this kind of seething anger that occasionally explodes, but mostly is kept under control. How did it feel to see the out-of-control images in Baltimore?
Well, it was heartbreaking. I saw, streets that, for a good part of 7 years, part of the year I was living in Baltimore, and I know Pennsylvania, I know North Avenue, I know Montgomery Mall, and so it just it broke my heart. I totally understood, as an actor, I'm a student of human behavior, and what induces certain behavior, what induces rational and irrational behavior. And the thing that we all have to realize is we can't pretend like we don't know why. Everyone, we've been answering the question why very, very astutely, very in a very complex manner. I thought, one of the reasons we're celebrated as a television show on The Wire is because we answered those questions of dysfunction. I would say that the show The Wire wasn't just about cops and criminals. It was also about politicians and policy and its dysfunction. It was about the police department and its dysfunction. The thing that I want to reiterate to people is we know why. You would know how you would react if placed in a cyclical environment of lack of opportunity, lack of education. People benefit in this country by keeping an underclass. I see that in two cities that I love dearly, New Orleans and Baltimore. They remind me of each other. There are people that make decisions and policy to make sure that there's an underclass. We have to understand that it's generational. Redlining, which is making sure there's no insurance or economic development or opportunity, educational opportunity that we thought came about in some long ago, far away place called Jim Crow, where you redlined a community, was actually memorialized in our laws, in our policy. You couldn't get an FHA loan. That the whole term redlining comes from FDR. administration, which is amazing to think of, you know, the great progressive, where, you know, there was the red line around those areas where you could not get a government-backed mortgage in the red zone, which was marked by red lines. And that was a red zone was defined by any area that had gun runners, prostitutes, and a Negro. Just one Negro.
Many commentators have talked about the divisions in the neighborhoods in Baltimore and just the long history that exists there. And I think there's, you know, there is a sense of why that I think people either are yearning for or feel like they understand. But in some of your tweets over the past week, I sense a certain kind of frustration. For instance, these are not protesters. These are criminals disrespectful of the wishes of the family and people of goodwill. What would have been a great display of rage, you write, would have been going to the Department of Justice and demanding a meeting with Loretta Lynch on her first day. I sense you're trying to write a script that would be better than burning down the CVS deal with this issue.
Yeah, because we all know. It's almost cliched. We know. 1968, the rage, we burned down the neighborhoods, and, you know, Watts, West Baltimore, Newark, all are still suffering from the damages of those neighborhoods. I think it would have been a different outcome had those kids gone to Roland Park and burned down. I think there wouldn't have been some sort of let's hold back and let them vent attitude if they had gone to Owens Mills and started burning down. As long as, you know, it's a poor community and there's outrage and it's burning down in a poor community, people allow it to happen. We need to hear from people in Roland Park. We don't need to hear from the cast of The Wire. We need to hear from the people in Georgetown and the Upper East Side and uptown New Orleans, and realize and hear the voices of people who say, you know, they may not look like me, they may not have much in common with me, but they are a part of my community too. And I should care about what happens with them. And the divisions in our communities are not happenstance. And people have to stop acting as if it's some sort of weird alien display of venting and outrage. People should be outraged because they understand where it comes from. And if we really want to change it, we know what needs to happen. The same thing that you desire in your community is what is desired in that community. We cannot become desensitized to the fact that we watched a cop 2 weeks ago shoot a man in the back. We cannot become desensitized to the fact that someone rides away or runs away from the police, he's arrested, and his neck is broken. We cannot become desensitized to seeing someone who, in a struggle with the police officer, is videotaped in a chokehold, and he dies saying, "I can't breathe." And
although it sounds like from your tweets that the kind of violence that you see on the streets of burning down your own neighborhood allows people to go, "Oh, it's just the alien, crazy young people."
Yes.
It allows that desensitization to take place.
Right. It becomes an outlet for those who don't want to face the real issue. It gives them an out. It can then change the paradigm and change the story, saying, "Oh, it's about the violence that we see instead of about the criminality of having a kid or a young man get arrested and have his neck broken and die 2 days later."
Now, of course, if they'd gone up to Owings Mills, I mean, then you got the line in The Wire: "All we got is bodies." I mean, if they did that, then you'd see on the street what would happen,
right,
there. And you alluded to it, but to not to wish that on anyone. Who would you call up there to be a part of this conversation? Who would you get on the line and say, All right, we gotta sort this out here.
Well, first of all, everyone and anyone, you know, it's all hands on deck. There but by the grace of God go I. And if we allow ourselves to think that they are other, you know, that we criminalize anyone who's poor, if we allow people to go, well, you know, you didn't do the things that are necessary. You didn't pull yourself up by the bootstraps. You didn't exercise your right of self-determination. You know, it's the same argument, whether it's in gentrification or lack of opportunity in education. I told someone the other day, I was in a neighborhood here in New Orleans where I am, and I said, don't think the people that were here before you didn't know how wonderful this neighborhood was. Don't think that they didn't understand the value of these homes. But they couldn't get the attention of infrastructure being brought into their community, resources. They couldn't walk into a bank and get a loan like you. There are challenges and obstacles placed in front of them that doesn't allow them to actually to actualize the very thing that you are benefiting from. So it's the same thing with communities like this. If we saw frat boys from Georgetown getting shot in the back by police, if we saw the girls of Bryn Mawr being choked to death by a police officer after a sleepover, this country would be outraged. And the other thing that really disturbs me in the conversation, I hear this all the time, where is this outrage when it's black-on-black crime with all the murders that have happened in Baltimore? Anyone who says that doesn't know what Google is. There's been constant indignation and outrage and attempts to change the paradigm of young black men who choose the only opportunity they have, an underground black market of illegal drugs, which comes along with criminality and comes along with violence. That's how they do a takeover on the streets. Violent. It's not something that's done very slickly with a venture capitalist on Wall Street. It's like, oh, I have to expand my business. Let's do a takeover. So we know what's happening and we know why. They're not included in the regular economy. There's an underground economy that they're gonna create. Everyone wakes up and goes to work in the morning. Where's your job is the question. So our feigned ignorance of what are the root causes of this violence, what are the root causes of the police brutality, even the most offensive term in police lingo, the paddy wagon, came from a time when police used to treat Irish Americans the same way we see young black men being treated. Police brutality, murdering them, shooting them in the back, choke holes, killing them. They did something that was very interesting turn of the century ago. The Irish American community said, you know, we're going to become a part of the police. We're going to become the police. So the police will stop doing that to our community, which is interesting because I learned from most of the African American police officers that I studied when I studied for The Wire, that's the reason they became police. This is not a reflection of the people of my community. And so that's why I'm going to join and become a police officer, because I'm going to do this for Mr. Joe and Miss Ann and all the good people who wake up every day with their families and try to do good. And so we should reach out to those voices in the police department so they can say yes. You know, give voice to the corruption and this idea. Every policeman in this country knows a cop who carries a sandwich, as they call it. That gun that's in a little paper bag in the trunk or somewhere, so when there's an illegal shooting, they can drop it. We heard about it. We all know about it. It's not police lore. And then we saw it on the tape in the Carolinas when the police officer shoots the guy in the back, and then he drops the taser by him and reports to make sure we're going to mark it down and reports, hey, he grabbed from my taser. And then we had the video evidence that it was a lie. So let's not put our heads in the sand.
Well, then, you know, where is this? you know, where is this headed? I mean, on one level, you could say it's all unraveling and that those underground tensions and dishonesties and betrayals economically and in terms of criminal justice are finally reaching a boiling point, and that, you know, we're really devolving into a class war, and that's what America's going to be about in this century. Or other people say that, no, actually, we're getting more of an honest discussion, and it's going to be loud, and it's going to be violent sometimes, but this sense of awareness that actually this is coming into the surface, into the light, is what's going on here, and on the other side of this is something really positive. Do you have any sense of either of those outcomes or another of your own?
I choose the latter. I choose the latter, that we are lifting the veil of apathy. We're lifting the veil of selective ignorance about things happening. And we're exposing it and making sure that we give people an honest opportunity to either do something about it, but they know the alternative. I feel a little optimistic that we have an opportunity here because it's so clear that there's the demise of the American empire, as David Simon, my old boss, likes to say. People realize that it's not just a given that we are going to continue this sort of behavior and still succeed as a society. We're on a road of self-destruction, and that if we don't take the time, energy, effort, and resources, put resources into the greatest commodity that we have as a country, as a society, and that is its people. If we don't put our resources into our people, then we know that we're going to self-destruct. And I think that the lifting of this veil gives people a sense of urgency and realize that it's not in some far-off place. The media has been very specific about saying, well, Baltimore is just 40 miles from the White House. You know, it's that close. Well, you know, Southeast is even closer. Anacostia is even closer. And this could happen in Southeast easily because it's the same powder keg and conditions. Now, so it's an opportunity for us to put solutions on the table. The one thing that I'm proud of when it comes to The Wire is the fact that we brought attention to issues of dysfunction and the dysfunction of the drug war, that even in the highest levels of government, you know, going all the way to the president, we realized there was some self-reflection in saying that we need to change this policy. There needs to be nullification on juries when it comes to nonviolent drug prosecutions. If we don't change the incarceration rate nonviolent drug offenses, which comes out of a need for people to become a part of an economy, and if they're not a part of the regular economy, they're going to be a part of the underground economy, which is going to deal with some illegal drugs. And then this incarceration rate that is so imbalanced, while we watch people on Wall Street do white-collar crime that had a much more damaging effect in the entire country, get off lightly and not even go to prison, then we should nullify those juries. If I'm on a jury where someone is being convicted for a nonviolent drug offense, I'm going to let him off until you change the policies. Community benefit agreements. If you're not going to invest in the neighborhoods, you're not going to bring investment or create an economic engine here, then what we're going to do is we're going to demand of you a community benefit agreement. We want 1 or 2% of your marketing budget to come into a designated school or designated charity that we have, or after-school program, or something that's going to bring some benefit to our community, or we're going to boycott your store, or we're going to boycott your construction site. It's it's that sort of revolution. As someone was challenging me in the social media world, they said, you know, this is a revolution, it has to be violent. Well, a revolution is demanding on the first day of Loretta Lynch's tenure as Attorney General that we're not going to wait. We want the federal government to come into Baltimore right now. We've seen it. We know what the issues are, and we want a consent decree. You don't get federal dollars into the Baltimore Police Department until these things are changed. And when you start to do that, then it's proactive. We have a consent decree in New Orleans right now because it's the same thing that happened in New Orleans. We had police officers 10 years ago in Katrina take a body of a citizen that was shot in the back by another officer, burn his body on the levee, decapitate, and steal the head. And unfortunately, they're not going to prison because of, the technicalities of...
Grim one, that story for sure.
Yeah. You know, and Danziger Bridge. I live in that neighborhood where people were crossing the bridge and, you know, shot in the back by police officers who were told they were carrying guns. I mean, that has to stop. You know, just the innuendo of being black and male and walking gives a police officer this right to say, I feel endangered. And, you get to go home while that person goes to the morgue is unacceptable.
Well, Wendell, thanks so much for speaking with me.
Thank you, John.
Wendell Pierce is actor known for his role as Bunk Moreland in the HBO series The Wire and Antoine Baptiste in Tremé.
You gotta help me keep the devil down in the hole.
To live in Jerusalem is to see the most beautiful light in the world, I think. A warm pinkish hue that may come off the distinctive stone everywhere. No one has fully explained it. Everyone has experienced it. Jerusalem is also a place of unspeakable ugliness, violence, religious-motivated intolerance, anger and suspicion amidst love and a spiritual peace found nowhere else in the world. Those contradictions are what I found in Jerusalem when I was there in the 1980s and 90s. Tom Friedman was just ending his famous stint as bureau chief for the New York Times, Joel Brinkley beginning his. In Jerusalem, the New York Times correspondent is like the 5,000-pound gorilla of the International Press Corps. This does not literally describe current bureau chief Jody Rodoran, but she understands the pressure and the scrutiny of her job. She's also experienced two wars in the Gaza Strip, two Israeli national elections, Palestinian success in the United Nations, collapsed peace talks, an impending U.S. nuclear deal with Iran, the Syrian civil war, and unprecedented regional chaos. It's been a remarkable 3 years, and it isn't over yet.
The level of viciousness and personal attacks is really distressing. And it's not just distressing because it hurts me and because people insult my husband and children and threaten them. It's distressing because I think of what it says about the devolution of the debate on this issue. And people are just so unable to empathize or see other people. I wrote a story last week about Memorial Day in Israel. And it was about a woman whose son was killed in the Yom Kippur War in 1973 and how for more than 40 years, people have come to her to a private memorial service every year, even though many of them know many other people who've been killed as well. It just sustained itself. And I think that happens all over Israel. And also 23 people, more than half of them, not her relatives, have named their kids after her son Gilad. Mm. And I got incredible feedback about the story, that it just felt like it really explained something about Israeli culture and was very powerful. And then I got a message from somebody I work with, a Palestinian official, who said, your lack of empathy for Palestinians is unbelievable. And I couldn't really understand the message because the story wasn't about Palestinians at all. And I asked him, I said, you know, did I not show empathy when I wrote about the Gaza artist? And I pointed out several other, I thought, very empathetic stories about Palestinians. And I realized later that this idea that you can't show empathy for both Israelis and Palestinians, or for both Hamas people and moderate Fatah people, or for Haredi Jews and secular Jews, I think it's really troubling. I mean, I have empathy for all kinds of people, and I don't think that it's a zero-sum game and that showing empathy for one side of a story requires a lack of empathy for another. I don't think that's playing out in other places in the same way.
No, and I think people measure your empathy, that there's a kind of a theoretical idea that there is a perfect balance of empathy. And in a place like Israel, how could you ever even know what such a thing would be?
I mean, I don't think empathy as a thing is measurable at all. But I also feel like this is a big concern I have about this supposed criticism of our coverage, is it's constantly takes this kind of scorecard approach, as though a piece of journalism or a political conflict can be measured like a basketball game. And as though the number of words that are coming out of the mouths of an Israeli or a Palestinian in a particular newspaper article affects kind of some balance of where the conflict stands. And I think that's just, life is much more complicated than that, really. And, you know, I wrote a story now about a year ago, a little bit less than a year, when the three Israeli teenagers were kidnapped and then killed. This was before their bodies were found. I spent some time with the mother of the American citizen who was among the kidnapped, this really incredible woman, Racheli Frankel. She showed the whole country an incredibly poised way of handling tragedy. And I wrote a story together about her and about the mother of a young Palestinian kid who was killed in the Israeli crackdown in the search for the three boys. And I got a lot of outrage from the right or from Jews about the idea of putting these two mothers together in one story, as though I was saying that their experiences were the same. And I thought, I didn't say they were the same. I just said they were both happening at the same time. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. you know, people should know that there are mothers on both sides. And there are things they have in common, and there are things that are totally different about them. And you could read both of them, and you could find empathy with both of them, and you don't have to decide whose situation is worse. Or you can decide. I mean, it's fine to decide who you think is suffering worse or who deserves it or whatever, but just know what's going on.
And that's something they're bringing to the story, not something you're bringing
exactly,
to the story.
Exactly. Yeah.
Do you think Israel sees an opportunity to resolve matters with the Palestinians or move forward with matters on the Palestinians, given that Syria is in complete chaos and Iraq is in complete chaos and Egypt is not doing terribly well? And, of course, you continue west, Libya is a nightmare. And they've got the Mediterranean, a cemetery, which is what the prime minister of Italy talked about. It seemed like if you could solidify some situation in Israel and the occupied territories, you might have an enclave that would have some security. Do people feel that way at all?
The short answer is no. When I got there 3 years ago, I feel like there were these kind of two arguments about how the regional changes affected the underlying question of Israel and the Palestinians. And there was one strong camp that said a time of regional chaos is not a time to make any moves. It's more risky to make any moves, and it's a time to kind of hunker down and wait the craziness out, and then we can address these other things. And then there was another camp that really talked about the idea of an island of stability, and maybe if you resolve this basic problem with the Palestinians, it would be a stronger face out to the region. That second camp, I think, has weakened over the last 3 years. There's a slim majority that still supports a two-state solution with the Palestinians. There's a much larger majority that thinks that's impossible. A good chunk of that is attributed to the Palestinian leadership and the idea that they are not a reasonable partner for peace. And another big piece of it is the regional situation, the idea that with the rise of Islamic extremism in other forms, that the threats are just too dangerous to make any moves. And then there's, of course, also a strain, I think a small strain, that just basically believes that the whole river to the sea should be in Israeli or Jewish hands.
Jody, thanks so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Jody Rodoran stopped by our studios on her way back to Israel. She is Jerusalem Bureau Chief for our partner, The New York Times.
Oh, that's where I want to be. But I guess I'm already there. I come home.
Thanks for listening to The Weekender. We love having you join us, and you can find us and The Weekender and be a part of The Takeaway all week long by just going to thetakeaway.org.
The one from another. Did I find you? Are you find me?
This has been The Takeaway Weekender Podcast. You can catch all our show's content by visiting us at thetakeaway.org. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thetakeaway and follow us on Twitter using the handle @thetakeaway.